these different steps that adversaries go through or used to go through is dead now because we have AI. I don't know if it's a fair take, because the assumption there then is that AI has replaced every threat actor. Malware does not just manifest on a system. Like, someone somewhere convinced a user to download and run a thing with elevated privileges. If they were following a hype train, then congrats, your entry vector was super smooth and easy.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, weekly Intel chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. Mr. Bromley, how you doing, sir? It's been a minute.
It has. Chris, what's going on, man? Happy end of March to you. We were just commenting before we went live. It is RSA week. And believe it or not, a little known factoid for all of our listeners here. Chris and I first met, I believe, at RSA or B-Sides San Francisco 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's 4 or 5 years ago now.
I can't remember now, but it was, and maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And regardless, that's where we first met. We hung out for 2 days. We worked the B-Sides booth by ourselves, and then we went and did RSA after that.
Mm-hmm. And I still remember Adnan Khan's talk about GitHub vulnerabilities from that B-Sides, because I was like, oh man, that's a little terrifying.
That's right. I remember that. And here we are a number of years later. This is not a sign, everyone. It's not a good sign or a bad sign that neither of us are at RSA, but RSA is going on in the background and there's lots of hubbub. But that does not take away from the world of threats and news that we're going to talk about. But man, it's good to see you. And
yeah, it's good to see you too.
A sentimental week, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, part of why I didn't go to RSA was I was in Regina last week giving a talk at the B-Sides there. So that was super cool. Always amazed to see such strong, vibrant cybersecurity communities all across Canada. I'm sure it's the same in the States, but this is my backyard. And it's just really cool to see those things happening everywhere.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Great to hear. I'm hoping there's some feedback or something we can watch from that.
Yeah, and it was actually 4 or 5 people came up to me. They said they're fans of the podcast or they watch Defender Fridays. And yeah, just super cool. Yeah, it's really,
that's
really
awesome.
Cool.
All right. So shout out
to Regina.
Cool to
yeah, I got my
for all of
my
you who were at RSA walking around looking for Chris and I'm sure there was probably several thousand of you. But for those of you who are doing that, neither of us were there. So find us at the next event. I don't know. Yeah. We'll see. Maybe we'll both be in Vegas in August.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Anyway, let's get to it. I'm sure everybody's sick of listening to us banter. Okay, so back with Iran, it seems to be top of the news. Since the onset of the conflict in the Gulf region, cybersecurity researchers have observed a noticeable rise in malicious cyber activity tied to geopolitical events. Bitdefender data shows that malicious emails targeting Gulf countries increased by about 130% after February 28th, the day the Ayatollah was assassinated. At its peak, malicious email activity reached nearly 4 times the pre-war baseline. However, researchers emphasize that while activity has increased, the actual operational impact of the cyber campaigns appears to be limited. One example involves the group Nasser Security, which resurfaced in March after disappearing in late 2025. The group claimed it had breached 3 energy companies in the region: Dubai Petroleum in the United Arab Emirates, CC Energy in Oman, and Al Safi, a Saudi-based gas station operator. If accurate, these breaches would represent a significant cyber campaign against regional energy infrastructure. Security researchers, however, found that the group's claims were largely exaggerated. According to analysis from ReSecurity, the attackers did not compromise the oil and gas companies themselves. Instead, they targeted supply chain contractors involved in engineering, safety, and construction work connected to these firms. These contractors often store project documentation and collaboration files related to larger infrastructure projects, making them easier targets for business email compromise and account takeover attacks. Nasir Security did obtain some legitimate documents, including reports, maps, and engineering diagrams connected to Dubai Petroleum projects. However, these materials were taken from a contractor rather than from the energy company directly. The group also falsely claimed it had stolen more than 413 gigabytes of data. Researchers say the authentic documents were mainly used to make the breach claims appear credible and to amplify the narrative of a successful attack. Verification is also difficult because many hacktivist groups rely on attacks that are hard to independently confirm, such as denial of service disruptions or website defacements. For example, the Group 313 team claimed responsibility for denial of service attacks targeting government and military services in Bahrain and Kuwait. While minor disruptions were reported, analysts could not verify the scale of the attacks or confirm the group's involvement. Analysts say that public claims are often part of the strategy. Announcements posted on platforms like Telegram create the perception that the hacktivist groups are operating broadly and successfully. This creates what researchers describe as a reputational fog of war, where organizations must respond to potential threats even when evidence is limited. Some analysts believe Iran may be coordinating activity among aligned groups through a rumored electronic operations room, while others argue most of these campaigns are designed primarily to create psychological impact rather than produce measurable effects on the conflict. So that's super interesting. It's like a PR for cyber activities during kinetic warfare.
Yeah, right? It's an interesting take. I mean, the way that I think about this when I first read through this, Chris, was very much along the lines of like, it's kind of a coordinated effort now, if you will. It's a coordinated effort where folks are recognizing there's more number and powers, and there's probably all sorts of, no pun intended, but like revolutionary concepts to be discussed here, if you will. However, interestingly enough, it's kind of like done from a cyber attack perspective. And it's these hacktivists being aligned, and it's these different groups, and it's all these really interesting scenarios where, and I'm kind of looking at, particularly as you talked about this electronic operations room, they then become this kind of unified force that moves everyone forward, and they move forward this message. They can coordinate on different attacks if they need to. They can coordinate on messaging. They can hit certain things. And what we're seeing is a lot of sentiment. And I'm not picking a side in this one. I'm just saying there's a lot of anti-Western sentiment that comes out of this, but it's directed in certain places, right? You and I have talked about like data centers getting hit, and that's very directly against American-led companies. I was also reading this morning that there are other Gulf states that are moving like assets, movable assets, out of the region for fear of political ties and retribution and stuff like that. So it's a very, very massive moving target as to like, okay, well, if you're within proximity of this thing, no matter how like, you know, maybe fragile you think that link might be, that might be enough for an attack. In which case, you know, having an organized message can actually be a really, really powerful tool. One of the things I was reading, I believe it was Bahrain as well. They had moved a bunch of the government planes to like other airports around the world. And this is kind of a thing that a few Gulf states are doing. They're moving their planes. And we're talking like private family planes, Chris, or, royal family assets and stuff like that, moving them to other parts of the world, just kind of sit and wait until this is over, for fear of, hey, that's a tangible asset that can get attacked. And what I think happens here, not to get away from the technical side of it, but what I think happens when you have these, you know, kind of coordinated, unified groups is they can shift that cannon a lot easier and put the pressure on. And if everyone wants to think about the flip side of this, if I've got 5, 6, 7, 10, 15, 20 independent hacktivist groups who are all screaming kind of the same idea, but the sub bullets are the different part, and then they start to step on each other, the message isn't clear. Well, we're supported by this and not that, and we believe this and not that. It's really hard to be like, all right, well, A, who do we take seriously? But it's also hard as a nation trying to be on the offense to build any sort of campaign that you can use as an asset. So that's what I really view this here as, like an odd weaponization and synchronization of hacktivist groups to help move forward the message that your country wants to send and whatnot. And again, I'm not taking right or wrong sides on either of this here, Chris. I'm just saying kind of as like a movement style thing, the groups are much better coordinated than they are discombobulated.
Yeah, all that coordination can make it seem like the impact they're having is much bigger and, you know, put everybody on their toes and devote resources to a threat that might not be real. So it does have an impact, even though they're not actually breaching these companies and in stealing stuff. So And on that note, I thought this one offered some timely information given the evolving threat landscape and the likelihood of increased wiper attacks, which are like the organizations linked with Iran who are actually doing stuff like the Stryker hack that just happened a little over a week ago now, where they, I think they bricked like 10,000 devices or something crazy. So
yeah, we talked, there's mobile devices in there too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
right?
Like employee phones. Yeah. So Unit 42 researchers are warning about an increased risk of destructive cyber attacks tied to the conflict involving Iran. The primary concern centers on wiper attacks, which are designed to delete data and disrupt operations rather than steal information or demand ransom. Several incidents have already reportedly affected organizations in Israel and the United States. Israel's National Cyber Directorate has warned that attackers have gained access to corporate networks and deleted servers and workstations in order to disrupt business operations. In some cases, the attackers were able to gain initial access using legitimate credentials belonging to corporate users. One group associated with these activities is known as Handala Hack. The group is also tracked under several names, including Void Manticore, Cobalt Mystique, and Storm 1084.
Oh, how fancy.
Although the group originally presented itself as a hacktivist organization when it appeared in late 2023, the threat intelligence community now assesses it as a state-directed front linked to Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security. According to Unit 42, the group's recent operations have focused on exploiting identity systems to gain administrative access inside corporate environments. Researchers say the group commonly begins its attacks with phishing campaigns aimed at stealing user credentials. Once access is established, attackers attempt to escalate privileges and take control of device management systems such as Microsoft Intune. Administrative access to these platforms allows attackers to perform high-impact actions, including wiping devices or deleting systems across an organization's network. Because these tools are legitimate enterprise management platforms, misuse of them can allow attackers to cause widespread disruption quickly once privileged access is obtained. Unit 42 recommends that organizations reduce the risk of these attacks by tightening identity security controls, particularly around administrative accounts. One major risk factor is the presence of standing privileges, where accounts permanently retain high-level administrative rights. Researchers recommend implementing just-in-time access models so that elevated permissions are granted only when needed and only for limited periods. Organizations are also encouraged to reduce the number of global administrator accounts and require strong authentication, such as multi-factor authentication and hardware security keys before granting elevated privileges. Additional protections include restricting administrative actions through multi-administrator approval processes, using dedicated secure workstations for privileged operations, and limiting where administrators can log in from. Monitoring systems should also be configured to detect suspicious activities such as mass device wipe commands or administrator logins from unexpected locations. Unit 42 also emphasizes the importance of maintaining a mutable offline backup so that organizations can recover if destructive attacks succeed in wiping systems or deleting critical data. So I liked a bunch of stuff in here. I like YubiKeys, so hardware keys, 100%. And, you know, least privileges for everybody. Like, don't take offense. You don't want access. You don't want to be the guy that sunk the ship because your password got leaked or somebody hacked your SSO. So, yeah, I think those are great advice. I also like two key systems. And then obviously backups. If you're not doing backups at this point, then you got problems.
How about MAA, Chris? Multi-administrator approval. I like this one too, especially during RSA week when most of your administrators might be out. Or
That's a two key system, right? Where you need two people to sort of authorize something, right?
This is where in Hollywood we both plug in our keys into the neon lit platform and we go 3, 2, 1 and we turn and then the screen goes counting down. Yeah. No, to be honest with everyone here, like this, not that I'm never dishonest, but this article. Which talks about the increased risk of wiper attacks. And there's something to take away from here is it jumps right into proactive hardening recommendations. And then the rest of it is kind of like ad driven and whatnot, but it's very quick. Like, hey, here's a thing that we've noticed. Here's a brief, so on and so forth. Here's what you need to get into to prevent it. And I love it that most of the article is hardening recommendations, things to do proactively. And Chris, they're all great, great things. Shoring up, enter ID, global administrator, CyberArk, privileged identity management, just-in-time access, as you mentioned earlier, YubiKeys, implementing RBACs, like all this stuff may seem like basic security to a lot of people, but I'm going to be honest with you, it's a necessary move for a lot of organizations. I still see things today where I'm just like, the easiest of controls would have prevented this from being a thing. And it's just great to have in there. Now, I will be fair with everyone. This Unit 42 article, of course, does promote Palo Alto products first, Cortex and AI-empowered enterprise DLP and XSIAM and all that kind of stuff. But that's not to say that the recommendations under the hood are not valuable. They definitely are. So if I could take away anything from this, it would not only be, obviously, they really like their product line, but also like implement some of these really strong measures. And this is not defense or mitigation of one type of threat actor. To me, this is some of the best actionable Microsoft hardening advice that you'll get out there. And for anyone who's, you know, not necessarily worried just about Handala hack or Void Manticore, Cobalt Mystique or whatever, we're not even getting touch on those now. But for anyone who's worried about just threat actors in general and their understanding of the Microsoft environment and how to abuse it, follow these hardening advice, these recommendations, and you'll be in a really good spot.
Yeah, and I'll touch on something you said too. I think most breaches today could have probably been prevented by simple controls that weren't in place.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the rare. I think that's the common. And I'll also say too, I think with these wiper attacks, like the risk is even higher because they're not trying to stay low and slow. They're coming in hard and fast and just trying to like delete the boot sector or wipe the disk. So
yeah.
All right. Next up, the hacking group known as Team PCP has expanded a large-scale supply chain campaign targeting widely used open-source software ecosystems. The operation began with a compromise of Aqua Security's Trivi vulnerability scanner, a tool commonly used in development pipelines to scan containers and software artifacts for security issues. Attackers gained access in late February after obtaining an access token tied to a service account with administrative privileges in Aqua Security's repositories. Because not all credentials and secrets were rotated immediately, the attackers were able to maintain access and continue manipulating the environment. Wah, wah. using that access, the attackers modified GitHub Actions tags and released malicious versions of Trivi packages. These versions distributed information-stealing malware designed to collect credentials, tokens, API keys, and other sensitive data from developer environments and CI/CD pipelines. The attack exploited the fact that many automated workflows rely on GitHub action tags that can be changed without altering the tag name or release metadata, allowing malicious code to run without obvious signs of tampering. According to a SANS Institute report, more than 10,000 CI/CD workflows were affected because pipelines referencing the altered tags automatically executed the malicious code. The campaign quickly spread beyond Trivi. Team PCP pushed malicious artifacts to Docker Hub, compromised VS Code extensions associated with Checkmarks projects, and targeted the NPM ecosystem. In the NPM attacks, malware was injected into at least 64 packages and more than 140 artifacts. The payload, dubbed Canister Worm, steals credentials and uses compromised publishing tokens to propagate into additional packages. Every developer or CI/CD pipeline that installs the infected package and has an exposed NPM token can unintentionally spread the malware further, allowing the attack to scale rapidly across the supply chain. The campaign also targeted the PyPI ecosystem.
PyPI.
PyPI, that's right. The campaign also targeted the PyPI ecosystem to compromise Light LLM, a widely used open source Python library that acts as a proxy interface for more than 100 large language model APIs. Malicious versions of Light LLM were designed to run silently during Python execution and harvest sensitive information such as API keys and environment variables. Because Light LLM is present in a large portion of cloud environments and is frequently connected to critical infrastructure and AI services, the compromise created a significant blast radius. Threat Intelligence Project's VX Underground estimates that roughly 300 gigabytes of data were exfiltrated from approximately 500,000 infected systems. Researchers also observed a destructive component within the campaign targeting Kubernetes environments. Malware used compromised credentials and exposed infrastructure to deploy privileged daemon sets across clusters, enabling persistent and lateral movement. If the malware detected that a system was configured for Iran based on time zone or local settings, it deployed a destructive payload known as Kamikaze. This component mounts the host file system, deletes top-level data, and forces a reboot, effectively destroying the entire cluster. Security researchers believe the campaign is evolving into a monetization phase through collaboration with Lapsus Extortion Group. Team PCP has publicly claimed responsibility for several of the supply chain attacks and suggested that the operation is ongoing. Analysts warn that by targeting widely used developer tools and cloud-native components, the attackers are exploiting high leverage points in the software ecosystem, potentially creating cascading compromise across thousands of organizations and development pipelines. Whew. So that was a big mouthful, but holy smokes, this is like an NPM worm.
This is
not the last we're going to hear about this one, I'm sure.
No, and this is also, I think, one of the most significant versions of a software supply chain attack you and I have talked about before. We have mentioned how, there's been kind of supply chain or package compromises before. We've talked about it. We've seen NPM get hit. We've seen PyPI get hit. I think we might have even talked about Rust at some point. But regardless, it's just like, kind of normal. And normal is the wrong word. But we've talked before about people putting in, malicious images, malicious code, getting someone to download what they think is legitimate and that kind of stuff, And then that resulting in malware being deployed. In this case, this is just, wild. Taking over a GitHub Actions vulnerability involving mutable tags, which first off I thought was interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Because that right there is like, okay, we have an idea of kind of what to do here and, how to take advantage of a pretty standard automated flow that a lot of organizations use. And then it just kind of scaled up from there, where this canister worm campaign comes through, and now they're like going after light LLM. And Chris, I view this as one of those like one to many really large blast radius style things, because it's not some esoteric library that, oh, we hope maybe a few people will download this thing like you and I have seen before. Mm-hmm. Instead, this is a Kubernetes wiper, number one. So like, let's be clear, everyone, we're in the world of destructive malware here. We're not in the world of just information stealing or, scrape your crypto wallet or something like that. This is, going after the big guns, going after the infrastructure, number one. And then number two, it then actually has really, really specific targeting inside of it too. This decision tree right here is crazy. If it is a Kubernetes plus Iran, it deploys a daemon set, wipes every node. If it's Kubernetes plus elsewhere, it deploys a daemon set that installs a canister worm backdoor on everything. No Kubernetes plus Iran, RMRF root. No Kubernetes and no Iran, nothing happens. I mean, could you be more pointed in your decision tree? Could you be more targeted in your decision tree? But wow, just another evidence. And here we go right here. Here's kind of that, here's that workflow. If is Kubernetes, if is Iran, do this, else do that, if not poison pill, otherwise exit. And it's just like, wow, very, very targeted attack, number one. And this is, I think, kind of the inverse of what you and I started today's episode with. This is not an organized Iranian threat. This is an organized threat against Iranians,
mm-hmm.
if I'm not mistaken. No idea where it's coming from, but how about this kamikaze?
I kind of feel like the Iranian thing is a bit of a side quest here. Like it says they're moving over to do extortion and get some financial gain out of this. But hey, yeah. While we're at it, why don't we hurt the Iranians? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean this in a negative way because I truly don't know the answer. And anyone who's listening, if you know the answer to this, please find a way to get it to us, social media, LinkedIn, whatever it is. But like, how big of a Kubernetes population are you expecting in Iran? And mm-hmm. where I'm going with this, Chris, is usually when some of these, you get these like kind of self-propagating worms and that kind of stuff, right? They're kind of just crawling around the place and looking for stuff. And they're hopping from, tenant to tenant, environment to environment and whatnot. Like, how widespread are you expecting to get that you can have a geographical exclusion in what you do? And that's kind of one of the things that I take away whenever I read into these types of threats is, before you and I have talked about malware that targets like journalists and dissidents and stuff like that, and we talk about it from like a spear phishing campaign because those groups are getting spear phished, or those folks, we've talked about like mobile vulnerabilities too. And those usually target those groups because they use it for communications and encrypted chats and whatnot. And in those types of situations, there isn't really a if not journalist cause. It's more like we send it to the people who we want to click on this thing. Mm-hmm. Here, to me, it's kind of like, hey, if you happen to land in this country, do this. If you don't, do that. And I always look at that as like, what a massive kind of, aim that you can basically be like, okay, I'm going to launch this piece of malware. And if you're in this country, like, pardon my language, but screw you. And here's what this, if you run this and you don't run that, if you do this and if you don't do that, it's like, it's this really interesting amalgamation of things where it's kind of like, what was the intention here, number one, but also how wide did you think that this would get?
Yeah, honestly, like I can't say this for sure, but I in my mind, I see the guy sitting there working on it 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. more starts. And he's like, you know what? I'm on Team USA. I'm just going to throw this in there, you know? So if, I don't know. I just feel like it this isn't the focus, but it's sort of like,
It became a side quest. One,
yeah, totally.
But why this? Why? If you're in Iran, your whole data set gets wiped. If you're not, you still get the back door.
Yeah.
But only if you have Kubernetes. It's just such an interesting, Chris, I'm going to frame it another way. All right. The individual writing this, he got through steps 1, 2, and 3. And then he got to the end and he was like, what if they don't have Kubernetes and what if it's not Iran? And he was like, meh. All right. You're safe. Forget it. I'm done. I'm tired
It'll
of writing
be in the
malware.
Next version.
You get version 2 for everyone else.
All right. This last one I thought super interesting. Article claiming that the kill chain is dead in the age of AI. So let's dive in and see what it has to say about that.
Sure it is.
right. In September 2025, Anthropic disclosed an incident in which state-sponsored threat actors used an AI coding agent to conduct an autonomous cyber espionage campaign targeting 30 organizations worldwide. According to the report, the AI system handled roughly 80 to 90% of the operational tasks involved in the intrusion. These tasks included reconnaissance, writing exploit code, and attempting lateral movement within victim environments. The case demonstrated how AI agents can automate much of the work traditionally carried out by human attackers. Traditional cybersecurity defenses are often built around the concept of the cyber kill chain, a model introduced by Lockheed Martin in 2011. The framework assumed that attackers must move through a series of stages, including initial compromise, persistence, reconnaissance, lateral movement, privilege escalation, and ultimately data exfiltration. Each stage provides potential opportunities for detection by security controls, such as endpoint monitoring, identity systems, and network analytics. This model has shaped how many organizations design their detection and response strategies. AI agents challenge this model because they already possess many of the capabilities attackers typically try to obtain during an intrusion. These systems often operate continuously and integrate with multiple enterprise platforms such as Slack, Salesforce, Google Drive, and ServiceNow. They are commonly granted broad permissions and are designed to move data between systems as part of the normal workflows. If an attacker compromises an AI agent, they effectively inherit its access, permissions, and operational context. As a result, many of the traditional stages of the kill chain can be bypassed entirely. The OpenClaw incident illustrates the risks associated with compromised AI agents. In that case, researchers found that approximately 12% of skills available in the platform's public marketplace were malicious. The system also contained a critical remote code execution vulnerability and more than 21,000 exposed instances. Once connected to services like Slack and Google Workspace, a compromised agent could access messages, files, emails, and documents while maintaining persistent memory across sessions. Because these actions mirror normal agent behavior, traditional security tools designed to detect abnormal activity may struggle to identify the compromise. The article argues that organizations need to improve visibility into AI agents operating within their environments. Many enterprises do not maintain a comprehensive inventory of AI agents or the SaaS systems they interact with. Security teams must understand which agents are deployed, what applications they connect to, and what permissions they hold. Without this visibility, a compromised agent could provide attackers with broad and legitimate access to enterprise systems while blending into normal operational activity. Yeah, so this is a really interesting space. I'm not going to comment on the kill chain is dead part, but I do think agent identity and even we just built this project called VibeRails where we sit in between the agent and the tool calls and use a detection process there. And I think both those things are going to become huge areas that we need to solve a lot of problems in, right? So there's agent identity, what is this agent? What is it supposed to do? What permissions does it have? And then when it's actually doing stuff hey, that doesn't look right. We need to get in the middle of that and stop it now because they move fast and they can be compromised because you're never going to stop prompt injection with LLMs. It's theoretically baked into the thing, right?
Yeah, I will address the cyber kill chain is dead comment only because I think there's a little bit of marketing into it. Not that it's a bad thing, but
yeah,
this whole idea of these different steps that adversaries go through or used to go through is dead now because we have AI. I don't know if it's a fair take, because the assumption there then is that AI has replaced every threat actor. And that I don't agree with that assumption. I think AI is to be considered a tool.
It's a mech suit.
It's a mech suit. There are adversaries who use it. Now, they may speed up some processes and some parts of the kill chain and that kind of stuff. But like tried, true, trusted hacking is going to start with reconnaissance and initial access and whatnot. Now, your form of initial access might change, right? And your persistence might be granted to you by the user, as weird as that sounds. So you might have a user install a plugin and give it, you know, system local admin root privileges or whatever, because they don't know any better. It doesn't take away those phases just because the adversary didn't have to work for it in a weird way. And that's what I think is kind of being called out here, is like, oh, AI automates all this, so it's not a phase anymore. I said, no, the user accepts a EULA, or they don't read it and they don't accept it or whatever, but they just install this thing and run it as root. Like, just because that subverts a bunch of the kill chain phases, right? And to me, Chris, the reason why I'm so hesitant to like agree with something like this, and this isn't, you know, picking on anybody here, it's just this article in particular, is malware does not just manifest on a system. Like, someone somewhere convinced a user to download and run a thing with elevated privileges. If they were following a hype train, then congrats, your entry vector was super smooth and easy, right? But if someone was going along and reading a thing and they clicked on the malicious version versus whatever, there was still time to set up that infrastructure. There was still time to create those malicious libraries and whatnot. And then the other thing that the kill chain has always encapsulated for me, which I don't know if a lot of folks have captured, when we think of the cyber kill chain, you know, there's the largest portion of the kill chain can feel like the steps where the adversary is in the environment doing a particular thing. They're not always linear. Some steps are recursive, right? Like, you may escalate privileges multiple times. You may establish persistence multiple times. You may interact to counteractions and whatnot, and active defense measures. But that's always been a very lengthy period of time. And most people have based that against like dwell time, an adversary's length of time in an environment, how long the IR took. And, you know, oh, the adversaries had access to the environment for 3 months. And during that 3 months, they did all these things and whatnot. Well, the other balloon in the cyber kill chain, if you will, and that's the thing that can expand and be pretty significant, is that initial infrastructure time. How long do you think it took to write that many malicious OpenClaw libraries or plugins? How long do you think it took to write that library? Now, the time to write those malicious things probably is shorter this year than it would have been in 2023. And in 2023, it was shorter than it would have been in 2018. Mm-hmm. And in 2018, it was shorter than it would have been in 2013. The fact that it's exponentially moved quicker does not take away the fact that it's just moved quicker. So to me, it's kind of like the kill chain still has some rock solid foundation.
It's just the timeline's condensing.
The timeline has condensed, and that doesn't take it away. And you could pick any manufacturing process and throw it in here. And it's like, you know, do we build homes the same way, or houses, I should say, do we build houses the same way in 2026 as we did in, you know, 1980? No, but are the core steps still there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And all we've done is change the materials, made it faster. And yes, the process looks very different.
So we need to get faster.
So either we need to get faster and stop pretending that AI is the only threat actor and adversary out there. That's all the other thing I'm going to say. Treat it as a tool and understand your adversaries are doing the same thing. Because Chris, you know this as well as I do, because we've both seen it. Any adversary who's out there and is just shotgunning attacks through an LLM, they're creating more noise than success.
Sure.
It's going to be very easy to see.
For now, anyway.
For now.
Yeah. We'll check back in a year and see if we still feel so confident.
Oh, but, man. I can only imagine the things we'll be talking about then. Hopefully, Iran will be gone from our purview for a while.
It's wild, though, eh? Like, a year now, I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen. Before, I used to feel like that 10 years, and then it got 5 years, and now it's like, and even a year seems like a long time, given that in the last year we've gone from MCP to skills, and now we're using CLI directly as the recommended way. Like, it's just crazy how fast things are moving. So it's exciting and it's a little bit scary, but I think it's more exciting. I think, like, if you're technologists and you're in this stuff, you can move forward with it, but don't take too big a break, because it'll be hard to catch up.
100%. I'm with you on that one.
All right, sir. Thanks for doing this again, and we'll see you next week.
Always a pleasure. I'll see you next week.
All right. Take care, bud.
Thanks. Bye.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.